At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling Podcasting Network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
To Wrestling Omakase, it is episode number 221, and this week I am very pleased to be joined by a first-time guest. Hello, Devin.
Hey, John. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Very loud car in the background there as you were introducing yourself.
Well, we live in New York. These things happen.
It's true. Everybody always, like, gets on me for all the background noise, and it's like, what do you want me to tell you? The ice cream man is here. I can't help it. He loves his neighborhood, but... the people who live out in, I guess, the suburbs or whatever don't understand it, but what are you going to do?
Liam in Australia, who's just surrounded by kangaroos.
Yeah, exactly. So, of course, like I said, you're a first-time guest. Pretty much just, I needed a guest this week, and I know you watch this stuff, so I figured you'd be a good one to bring on. I don't know if you don't write for any websites or anything, right?
No, I don't.
Yeah, you just, I mean, I know you because you DM me a lot on Discord. So if anyone wants to know how to get on the show,
harass John.
DM me a lot on Discord.
I'm sorry about that. Should I not DM you?
No. I'm just saying that's how I know you.
I like that you asked me to be on without knowing my name.
That's true. I had no idea what your name was. I just know you as Gig Me Like a Butcher on the Discord. But no, I mean I don't mind your DMs at all. But I'm just saying if people want to know, I guess, how to get on the show.
I think my plan was originally to be on for Fantasticomania, but then I stopped watching CMLL. So
yeah. So we're here, of course, to discuss two different shows, the King of DDT Finals and the Elite version 1. I originally pitched it to you as DDT Finals and then there's Noah Corrigan, but that Corrigan like had a really boring card, just a bunch of tags basically. And then I forgot that Elite was this week and I was like, wait a second. Obviously, we have to talk about Gleet. So.
I actually saw the Corican card. And I was like, why don't we just do Gleet? But it felt weird because I was the guest. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But yeah, Gleet, of course, was back on July 1st. And the King of DDT Corican was yesterday, July 4th.
The only interesting thing to come out of Noah was the N1 schedule.
Oh, what does that kick off?
September 12th at Corican. Then there's like 3 days, I think the 18th through 20th, that are studio shows. Then the 26th at Corican, and then October 2nd at Corican, and that's it.
Okay, so it'll be a short one this year.
Yeah.
And then I guess they're also, I guess it'll be up against the G1 again? Because it'd probably be the same time that
because last year G1 was late September to like October 12th.
Yeah. I think. And I think it sounds like it's going to be the same thing. So, but yeah, there you go. So, Devin, when I have a new guest on here, I always like to start by asking them, how did they get into, or how did you get into pro wrestling? And specifically, how did you get into Puro, since that's what we mostly discuss here?
I got into wrestling, I think, early fall of 98. It was like when they were doing the Mankind Rock thing that culminated at Survivor Series.
Mm-hmm.
And then I kind
of... Realize I have no idea how old you are either. Are you like my age?
I'm a little younger than you. I was born 88.
Oh, yeah, barely. Yeah, it's like 2 years.
Yeah, so I said a little.
I wasn't calling you. Someone says they're a little younger than me, I think like 90, I think.
Yeah.
Like 88 to me is like almost the same age. Yeah. But
I'm the same age as Joel from Super J Guest.
Oh,
yeah. So then like I kind of gave up in 2002, like after it got really dull. And then I got bored and got back into two and sort of watched WWE and ROH. And then when Jeff Jarrett brought over Wrestle Kingdom, that's when I got into New Japan. And I think a year
later. So you were another Wrestle Kingdom 2015, right?
2015, yeah. Wrestle Kingdom 9.
Yeah, so you were another Wrestle Kingdom 9 guy.
But then I hopped right on with New Beginning.
Yeah, there's a lot of Wrestle Kingdom 9 people, I feel like. That's a really, because of the Western pay-per-view, then that's a really popular one.
I always find it really funny that Jeff Jarrett's like one of the biggest reasons for the New Japan Western expansion.
It is pretty funny. It's like everybody has Jeff Jarrett to thank. But yeah, there you go. That's how Devin got started. Anything else been going on with you lately, Devin? What have you been doing, up to?
Nothing. I work from home like everyone else does now, and it's like
quiet. I had like a fucking a scare with that. Where my boss during one of our weekly Zoom meeting on Friday was like, yeah, we want to start bringing people back in the office twice a week, which, you know, twice a week doesn't sound that bad, but my commute is like murder. Cause you know where I live, I think. And it's like,
yeah, basically, you live in the Bronx.
Yeah. I mean, we don't have to get into the exact area, but it's really, I live basically in this neighborhood that's like close to the Bronx Queens border. And it's a long fucking bus ride to New York City or a bus to a subway, which is also really long. To Manhattan proper. So I was not looking forward to doing that commute again, even twice a week. But, you know, I basically asked my boss, I was like, hey, does this include me? Do I have to do this? And she's like, oh, no, I know your commute is awful. And you do your work every day. It's, you know, these unnamed other people who I think need the structure of being back in the office because we can't even tell when they're working. And I was like, oh, okay. As long as I'm not included, I don't really care.
I live in Southeast Brooklyn.
You live in like what, Southeast Brooklyn?
Yeah, I'm like 15-minute walk from the train.
Yeah, I mean, I would kill to be that. I mean, basically, the closest subway to me is the 6 line, which sucks ass anyway, and it's like a 25-minute bus, local bus ride. It is not close.
Sorry for stepping in you. I was going to ask you if you're near the D line because I think we'd be on the opposite ends because I'm like the second to last stop in Brooklyn.
Yeah, nowhere near the D-line.
Okay.
So, like, the closest thing, I think the closest thing after the 6 is, like, the A and the B. Yeah. And that's still, like, another 15 minutes on local bus. So pretty much when I go into Manhattan, if I don't feel like spending money on Uber, I almost always take the express bus, which, you know, can take, on a good day, it can take less than an hour, like 45 minutes to 50 minutes. On a bad day, which is many days, especially work days, it can take like an hour and a half. So basically save no time compared to the local bus to subway thing. But, you know, it sucks. And I'm glad I don't have to do it twice a week. And, you know, when I go to Manhattan now, I just usually just take Uber. Because, you know, when you're only doing it like once a week or less, it's really not that bad.
Yeah. No.
But yeah, that was my big scare. So I'm glad I'm still apparently allowed to work from home full time, which I do not, like I said, I do not want to go. I mean, I'm really not one of these people that like hates being in the office. It's really just a commute for me that I just do not want to do again.
I just got used to spending all my time with my dog.
I got used to spending all my time with all my, like, my giant TV. And now I just got a new sound bar. It's so good. The Sonos Arc. It's like, it basically makes everything sound not as close to like theater sound and like, you know, being in the concert hall for, you know, music as you can get without like a full surround sound system.
Did you just buy it to fully appreciate the Number Girl Blu-ray?
Yeah, pretty much. But I mean, that was one reason. But I mean, I really just bought it because somebody else in the voice wrestling Slack bought one. It was Chris Samsa, actually, and he was like raving about it. And I had it was in the back of my mind. I was like, you know, I had been thinking about getting a sound bar for a while because it's like, okay, I have the TCL Sixers is a TV I got back in October. It's a fantastic TV, especially for the price, but the sound is horseshit. Like this, it sounds worse than my old like Samsung HD TV from like 2008. So it's a thing apparently with like 4K TVs now is the sound is getting worse and worse. They just were putting less and less care into it. I guess because so many people buy sound bars now, they just don't feel like they have to put that much effort in. Plus, these TVs are so thin, so there's not a lot of room to put the like any kind of speakers in there that are decent. So, you know, it's a well-known issue with modern TVs that the speakers generally suck. So I was thinking of getting a soundbar, and he was raving about the Sonos Arc. When I looked it up, it's like, okay, it has Dolby Atmos support without needing anything else. Especially I wanted that without needing a subwoofer, because like this soundbar by itself is already probably pushing the limits of what I can get away with in my apartment without the neighbors revolting. So I figured, you know, I definitely don't need a separate subwoofer. I mean, the only thing against it is very expensive. So I had to like debate if I wanted to justify paying the price, but I did pay for it.
I feel like the saga of your television has been like a 6-month theme on Omakase.
It may have been, but yeah, the soundbar really is like, you know, it just makes, if you can find Dolby Atmos music, which is really hard to find, like Apple Music only has, I went through my entire library and I think there's like 5 songs on there that have the Dolby Atmos spatial audio so far. So it's really limited so far. But when you do find those songs, I mean, it sounds amazing. Like it sounds as close to you're in the concert hall as you can get. And like jazz especially sounds really amazing within spatial audio is what I've noticed.
We're going back to the 70s where like there's a new audio gimmick every 3 weeks.
Yeah, that is definitely true. But I mean, Apple Music is also, they rolled out lossless too, but like I can't fucking tell the difference between the regular and the lossless. It's pretty, and they even admit that it's kind of hard to tell the difference for most people. You know, my hearing's not that good. So, I mean, I really can't tell the difference.
Well, but one of those things is like you need a really good audio system.
Because yeah, I'm sure you probably do.
No speakers don't even carry the frequencies that you lose.
Yeah. But the spatial audio does make a big difference. I mean, I played songs back to back in regular and spatial. And like, it's just because spatial audio is much more simple where they're basically, because they have 9 channels to work with, right? On this, because it has the whole thing with Dolby Atmos is like you have like 2 that fire up and then like the standard like 7 channels from surround sound. And the spatial audio just separates all these instruments and all these vocal tracks into different channels. So it kind of makes it feel like the music is like surrounding you or like the music has depth, you know?
Yeah.
So that's the best way I can explain it. It's really cool if you can get to work. Like I said, the limitations are A, you need either a soundbar or a surround sound system that can do Atmos, which again are almost all on the expensive side right now. I'm sure the prices will come down eventually. B, you need an Apple TV. You can't play spatial audio through a soundbar surround sound without Apple TV. I mean, you can play, I think you can do spatial audio through certain headphones with Apple Music, but only if you want to play it through speakers and stuff like that. It's only through Apple TV, which I bought just for this because I'm a mark. And C, there's only like 10 songs or something. I mean, I'm exaggerating with 10. There's a very limited library of songs so far that support it.
So. Well, you have to go in and remix the thing. Probably. And also I'm a Roku user, so
yeah. I mean, I now have Roku because Roku's built into my TV. I have Apple TV and I have the Fire Stick hooked up for different things. So I have, the only thing I'm missing now, I guess, is Google TV, which I don't think I'll ever get, but I have 3 of the amazing streaming things all hooked up to this TV. But yeah, the spatial, so there's a lot of limitations, but once you get the spatial audio to work, it does sound fantastic. So definitely have to recommend that. But yeah, that's all I've been doing lately is listening to spatial audio and playing my PS5 with this soundbar. And
just I watched Dragon Ball last night.
Oh yeah, the original or Dragon Ball Z?
The original with the subtitles. Was it
fun?
It was fun. I watched the first three episodes.
I've never seen the original Dragon Ball. I've seen Dragon Ball Z, obviously.
It's kind of dirty for a kid's show.
Yeah, I always kind of heard that.
You see baby Goku's dick in the first episode. Repeatedly. Like he takes a whiz while fishing. And then a fish bites his tail, and while it's dragging him underwater, you keep seeing like the outline of his dick.
Yeah. Wow, you live in an even noisier neighborhood than I do, buddy. These cars going through.
Well, that's actually a fire engine.
So I say.
I guess they could burn to death for our podcast.
They could burn to death and not just went through a podcast. But yeah, the only anime I've watched lately is season 2 of Hamifura kicked off on, I think, Friday. I don't know if you've watched that. No, I haven't yet. It is so good. And you know, the season 2 episode 1, it was kind of like jumping back in, like, oh, here's what the characters have been up to since the end of the first season kind of thing. And, you know, there's not a lot of conflict yet or anything, but the characters on that show are so fun to be around and so, you know, just so amusing that you really don't mind it for that episode. You're just like, yay, it's Bakarina again. We're all very happy to see her.
I watched Jujutsu Kaisen for the first time.
I've heard people keep telling me to watch it. I haven't done it yet.
It doesn't have an ending, so fuck it.
Oh, yeah.
It's one of those, I'm not a big anime person, but like where they only adapt to a certain point in the manga.
Mm-hmm. So well, like, they could get another season.
Yeah, but I wasn't sure if it was or not. So it's just like, oh, you ended like a quarter of the way into the story.
There's so many shows like that. Like I was just watching, the other thing I've watched recently was the second OVA for Walter Coy, which is like another show that only adapted so much of the manga. And now it's been like 2.5 years or something since they've done the first season. No second season yet. The manga has gotten way ahead. And they've just been dropping these little OVAs, I guess, to keep people interested who don't read the manga. Or, well, they actually come back in with the manga in Japan, I think. But yeah, I watched it. The second one just came out, and there's supposed to be a third one in, I think, this fall. And then maybe we'll finally get a second season next year. But that's a very, like, cute show, if people listening don't know what that is. It's like Wonder Koi, Love is Hard for Otaku. It's one of the few anime I can think of that follows around people in their 20s at least, instead of like, you know, teenagers and stuff. And, you know, it's like all about their, you know, like their love lives and generally being difficult because they're, you know, hardcore anime manga fans and stuff. It's pretty much all there in the title, I guess. But it is a very amusing show.
I mostly like when the Japanese animate violence and or robots.
Yeah. I like a lot of that stuff too, but I've been more into... I mean, I've been watching a lot of Isekai lately, and then, you know, I've grown to appreciate, like, you know, slice of life, like rom-com stuff too, which is, you know, slower paced and not as, I guess, grim dark as a lot of anime can get. But
I like the phrase grim dark.
Yeah. I mean, I like grim dark stuff. Don't get me wrong, which is like, you know, I just haven't, like, I'm trying to think what is the last, like, grimdark thing I've watched? Maybe it was Tokyo Ghoul?
Jujutsu Kaisen is very grimdark.
Yeah.
But it has a very upbeat end theme song.
Well, that's cool. A lot of those shows do have...
It always amuses me. It's like, where Gundam Wing has, like, Just Communication as the opening theme, like, the weird techno song about falling in love in the rain.
And then the ending song is like, here's Valina with some animals and, you know, happy, happy. And it's like, this show is about everybody dying or like being
scarred. Unless you're a named character, then somehow you survive.
Yeah. Or you only get scarred by war in that case.
Yeah.
I'm like, it is not like the ending makes it seem like it's fun to be Relina Peacecraft. It is not fun to be Relina Peacecraft. I mean, that woman goes through a lot in that show.
Exactly. So.
It's very like it's
like the kind of ending you'd expect for a Pokemon or something.
Yeah. It's very, very strange. But anyway, we should probably talk about some wrestling because it's like 17 minutes. Let's get to these two shows. First, actually, I gotta plug the Patreon, so let me do that first. So you probably noticed that you only get 2 free episodes a month now on the free feed. The other two episodes for the month are Patreon exclusive. So if you want to go back to hearing Wrestling Omakase every week, you have to sign up for the Patreon. You can do that at patreon.com/wrestlingomakase. It is only $5. It's the start of a month, which makes it a great time to sign up. I can tell you this month, well, coming up next week, we'll have a new show covering the, because I know we haven't done much New Japan in a while, so we will cover the New Japan Summer Struggle in Sapporo shows next week. So that'll be exclusive to the Patreon. And then I believe 2 weeks after that would the other big Patreon will be the Russell Grand Slam and Tokyo Dome review. That will be exclusive to the Patreon as well. So, you know, that's how the timing works out.
And then there's those three shows that lead up to it, the two Osaka and the Nagoya.
Yeah. I figure we'll cover those as well. So, you know, we'll see what the cards are like, though. But yeah, for sure, the Tokyo Dome will be on the Patreon exclusively. So if you want to get that New Japan coverage, it is exclusive to the Patreon this month. Also coming up on the Patreon this month, we're going to resume our Tokyo Dome one match series. So if you weren't around for that last time, we were covering every Tokyo Dome main event in order. I go into other detail on the show in general. I talk about whatever else was going on the card. Whatever else was going on with the promotion. I use the Eggshells book. I always go through the chapter on that at least before I do the episode, and that has great information on each show. And then I obviously do some research of my own as well. But yeah, I mean, these are a lot of fun to do. We did them originally leading up to Wrestle Kingdom this year, and then after Wrestle Kingdom. So we did 1989 through 95, through like mid 95. So that's all up right now on the Patreon for you to listen to if you sign up. And we're going to resume in mid 95 with Keiji Muto versus Nobuhiko Takada later this week from the first ever New Japan versus UWFI Tokyo Dome show from, I believe, October 95.
It's October, yeah.
Yeah, so that'll be a lot of fun to do. We'll talk all about what led up to that feud and, you know, what kind of state UWFI was in and all that. But yeah, so that'll be a lot of fun.
So the last one you did was Bridge of Dreams?
Yeah, the last one I did was Bridge of Dreams, which will probably end up being the worst match of the series. That Shinya Hashimoto.
The semi-main event is great. The All Japan.
The All Japan, yep. Yeah. I mean, the All Japan six-man is awesome, but that New Japan, the main event was Masahiro Chono versus Shinya Hashimoto, which sounds great, but
it's the worst match they ever had together.
Yeah, it's horrible. I mean, they went out there and basically did nothing. And I don't even know. I mean, this is so, it was so bad that like people have had conspiracy theories that New Japan hated Tarzan Yamamoto so much because he was the editor of Weekly Pro Wrestling at the time, and you know, he was like very critical of New Japan at times.
Ricky Kyoshi's arch nemesis.
Yeah, and people don't know, the Bridge of Dreams show was this interpromotional show put on by the Weekly Pro Wrestling magazine. So this main event was so horrible that the conspiracy theory that New Japan hated this Yamamoto guy so much that they told their guys to go out there and have a shitty main event on purpose just to screw with him, it's plausible. I mean, this looked like two guys, that were fucking not trying to have a good match at all. Now, on the other hand, it kind of makes them look a bit terrible, given that, their rival company went on and had like a 4 3/4-star match, right before that. But like, I don't know.
It was Ricky was at the war show at Corken Hall that was going on at the same time.
Yeah.
He main evented.
So I don't know. Maybe he told him to go out there and fucking suck a dick or something. But
do you know the Fumi Saito story from that show?
I probably do, but why don't you go ahead and tell it?
He organized the whole show for Weekly Gong. Uh-huh. And then he had to go and cover WrestleMania 11 instead of actually going to that show.
yeah, that's awesome.
So yeah, he had to go to Connecticut to watch Bam Bam Bigelow and L. Taylor.
You know why Ward didn't participate, right?
Because
basically All Japan paid Weekly Pro Wrestling to do this really famously negative coverage of Super World of Sports, the Megane Super promotion, you know, where he was the one who kept referring to Megane Super as the black ship, that was sailing in off of their UWF backing. And then he deemed SWS as sellout pro wrestling and then got like intensely personal about Tenryu.
Well,
you know,
there is actually recovering a match with someone who is in SWS later. So I guess let's start with Gleed.
But yeah, Tarzan Yamamoto, you know, he revealed in his own tell-all book that he got paid 500,000 yen, which is about $5,000, by Giant Baba, of, you know, obviously of All Japan at the time, to you know, basically trash the SWS, which, first of all, that just sounds like a very small amount of money to do all that. I'm like, wow, you only got $5,000 to, like,
a lot of people didn't like Kenner either, so I think that might be it.
You only got $5,000 to destroy this man's entire promotion. It's like, okay. Yeah, I mean, FMW paid like $3,000 for a cover in the early years.
It's like, circulation was 400,000 a week, and it was only $3,000 to get on the cover.
Yeah, well, apparently. But I'm just saying, like, it only takes like less than double what it takes to get on a cover to get to trash a promotion for years and years. It's very bizarre.
I wonder what he paid the Japanese tabloids for the Tenryu penis enlargement rumor. around that time.
It's but there you go. That's where we left off, the Bridge of Dreams main event.
Okay.
And we're getting back to the you know, that house show main event, basically, is what it was. I mean, that's what it was. It was like it screamed like a house show main event in a random village, except like a bad one. And there was a main event of a Tokyo Dome show. It's very bizarre.
It's what you get punished for living in Gifu.
Yeah. So we covered that one as the last one, and now we move on to the New Japan versus UWFI feud. And like I said, that is available starting this week. We also just finished our Tanahashi Naito one match series, where I covered all 10 of the Tanahashi Naito matches.
That was very entertaining.
Thank you.
I was Patreon number 50, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. But you can talk about that. It's great to have somebody else other than me talk about how great the Patreon was. What did you like about the series?
I haven't listened to the last one yet, but generally with the one match series, I like kind of reliving the ones I was watching actively, and I kind of like just the historical context, even though I know a lot of it for New Japan on the ones prior. It's like a nice 25-minute walk the dog listen.
Yeah, easily. So there you go. So I try to keep them to like around 25, 30 minutes. Sometimes I fail and go like 45, but, you know, it depends on how much historical stuff I have to go into.
You tend to be more excited about Naito.
Really? This is a stunning revelation here.
I know. It's almost like if you did a Tai Chi one, like, they would all be an hour and a half long.
But there you go. That was the Naito Tanahashi series just wrapped up. And I probably will post a ranking on the Patreon tomorrow or Wednesday or something. So that'll be fun to do. But yeah, so the Tokyo Dome series, that's resuming on the Patreon.
Which was a lot of fun so far.
Yeah. So we might do a new anime omakase series episode finally. Should be all sorts of stuff coming up. And my anime omakase co-host is right here trying to very, very quietly, if she can, move something back into the bathroom. Do you want to say hello, Nicole?
Hello.
Okay.
Hi, Nicole.
My co-host says hello as well. Okay. Hello. So there's Nicole. We might do a slime anime omakase soon. That's what we were talking about. So anyway. Because we already did have my furry one, so I can't do that again until at least the second season's over. But yeah, so all that is on the Patreon. Again, patreon.com/wrestlingomakase. It is only $5, quite the deal, if I do say so myself. And you get all that audio content I mentioned, plus everything we've ever done, which includes, I mean, if you've never been a patron before, you can sign up right now. You can listen to, you know, if you have like a road trip or something coming up, I mean, I have tons of five matches episodes up on there that are exclusive to the Patreon that are basically timeless, you know, because we're all talking about old matches. I did a series on Naito versus Ishii for the one match, which were covered all those in order. I did a series on Tanahashi versus Okada, covering all those in order. And for both of those, going into everything those guys were doing in New Japan throughout the series. So
you also get like all the great mid-tour World Tag League, where you're ready just to give up on life because
they won't. You do get the one tag league reviews in every other tournament I've covered. If you want to go back and see how I dealt with that, then you also get the patron submitted matches, which are a lot of fun, and we'll probably do another round of those at some point. I forget. Did you submit something?
I submitted the Takashita Yoshiko match.
Oh, well, that was a great submission.
The Boneyard parody, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that was awesome. That was a lot of fun to talk about. So definitely tune in for that one if you missed that one. But yeah, so it's all there, patreon.com/wrestlingomakase. Only $5, and you can sign up today. All right, so let's get into our first of the two shows here, which was the King of DDT 2021 final from July 4th, Corken Hall, a 621 fans, super no vacancy because of COVID restrictions, of course. You know, we usually like to start at the top and work our way down. Doesn't make a lot of sense on this show, though, because then we'd be talking about the final before the semifinals. So I think I'll just go in normal match order here. So that means we start out here with the KOD 8-man tag team titles, Yoshiaki Yatsu, Akito, Hiroyoshi Yamato, and Keigo Nakamura defeated Chanshiro Takagi, Yukio Naya, Chikara, and Nabe Yakan. Yatsu submitted Naya with the jail lock in 1206. So Team Thoroughbred fails in V2, and Team Olympian have become the fifth KOD 8-man tag team champions. So Takagi and Yatsu started here. Yatsu's metal foot kicks were like extra devastating. That was kind of funny. And then he hit a nice belly-to-belly suplex as well before they both tagged out. I mean, if people haven't seen Yoshiaki Yatsu wrestling on one leg and the, you know, the, I guess, what would that be called? A prosthetic, right?
It's a prosthetic leg. He's also 60-fucking-4.
Yeah. I mean, he is impressive. I mean, for what he is able to do here. I mean, he was impressive in the Battle Royal back at the Cyberfight Festival as well. But the rest of the match was not that impressive, I have to say. Yamato and Takagi, they got in a sliding X-War. When they crossed X's, that was a little funny, I guess. Takagi came out on top with a stunner. And then Chikara came in and started throwing a lot of chops on Yatsu. And that's unfortunate because he has maybe the worst chops in all of wrestling. Chikara is a guy, he really straddles the line between funny bad and so bad it's not funny more than any other wrestler I've ever seen. There are some matches where I find him to be hilarious and I'm enjoying him, and he's trying his hardest and this is the best he can do and it's fine, but he's funny bad, or you just kind of want to root for him.
Oh, he's shit.
And there's other matches where he's just absolute fucking horrible, horrible shit. And that was his match. I mean, pretty much every moment he was in this match, he made this match much, much worse. So, you know, and he was in this match way too much, honestly, for an 8-man tag. So we have new champions. I just didn't think this was very good, though. Pretty dull and actively bad when Chikara was in there. I went like 2.25, which might even be generous, honestly.
I went 2.5 just because I was so amused by Yatsu.
That's fair. Any other thoughts on this one?
Not really. Do you know the Yatsu's first televised match was in Madison Square Garden?
I did not know that.
It was like Inoki thought he was going to be the super rookie. I guess he was like the first one. Oh, so he sent him to WWF, and his like fourth match ever was beating someone at the Garden. And it aired on TV Asahi. And then, you know, the rest of the story, he got disqualified from the Olympics famously.
Mm-hmm.
Because pro wrestling is a sport, including according to the International Olympic Committee.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That is something. But yeah, so there is your opener. But after that, the show does pick up quite a bit, thankfully. So match number two here was the King of DDT 2021 semifinal. Kanosuke Takeshita defeats Daisuke Sasaki with the modified chicken wing face lock in 1658. I do want to mention, as always, thank you to Dramatic DDT for the results. Jamie does great work, and you can find them at dramaticddt.wordpress.com. Sasaki, of course, he keeps trying to revert to his low blow illegal tactics that got him through the first two rounds. Very quickly in both cases, but he can't quite get to work on Takeshita. Paulie then pulls the ref out of the ring and beats him up.
Hold on, Takeshita was bragging.
About
his iron balls.
I think he said the iron dick or strongest dick or something.
Yeah, the iron dick. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you, DDT Pro English.
So then we had, So Paulie pulls the ref out of the ring and beats him up with most of the Sonic Club, or he beats up most of the Sonic Club on the outside. But then Sasaki accidentally low blows Paulie while Paulie's holding Takeshita for him. Takeshita dobs. Takeshita then hits a perfect Topekan heel on both of them on the outside. Matsui ends up getting bumped by a charging Takeshita in the corner, but then Takeshita blocks another low blow attempt by Sasaki and locks on his signature face lock, but there is no ref to see Sasaki tapping out. So I like the idea of doing a visual fall when you're going to have him win anyway, because it does kind of feel like he got swerved, you know? Like, I was like, oh, Sasaki's going to win again, I guess.
I kind of thought that too. What do you feel about the chicken wing face lock?
It's all right. It's not a submission I dislike, but it's not a submission I like either. Just kind of there.
So it's not the money clip.
It's not the money clip, but it's not. But yeah, it's not. It's really just there for me.
It's there, yeah.
A little bit later, Sasaki tries a suicide dive up to the floor on Takeshita, but Take catches him in midair perfectly and then drops him right on his head on the outside with a brainbuster. That was such a sick spot. And the strength to fucking catch this guy in midair, never drop him, lift him straight up into that brainbuster and just drop him on his head on the floor. That was just so sick.
I feel like they do it in every match and every time. I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a really impressive spot. There is a complicated reversal sequence that sees Takeshita eventually drop Sasaki right on his head after he had been trying a Rana. And then he locks back on his submission hold, and Sasaki quickly submits to send Takeshita on his way to the finals. I thought this was a damn good ending to the Daisuke Sasaki trying to cheat his way through King of DDT story. Takeshita was just able to overcome it and pick up the win. Very simple story, but definitely works. I went 3 3/4. Really fun match here.
I gave it the same rating. I did like the end when he hit the, what is it, Boosty called? The bastard driver?
Yeah, I think it's the bastard driver.
But he kept the waist lock up and just sort of hooked him up and then put on the Cobra Clutch. I kind of like that as a bridge.
Yeah, it looked really cool. So then we get to the other semifinal, which was Katsusada Higuchi versus Yuji Hino. Yuji Hino beat him with the fucking bomb and 12:36. I took much less notes on this one. I was just kind of just sitting there enjoying it because, like, you could really close your eyes and picture this match. It's the big boy battle. You have lots of power moves. You have
lots of brain claws.
Lots of brain claws. Lots of really hard slaps and chops to each other's chests. Both their chests were bruised really bad only partway through this match, especially Higuchi's, honestly.
Did you see that picture of Higuchi after the match that's going around?
No, I didn't see it.
Oh, you could see the fingerprints rip. It's gross.
Yeah, I can imagine. So then we, so basically Hino at one point absolutely takes Higuchi's head off with a pair of lariats. And then after pretty much right after that hits the fucking bomb for the pin. So this wasn't long or anything. Like I said, only 12 and a half minutes, but I thought it was awesome. Exactly the big boy battle you would want and hope for. This was my match of the night. I went 4 stars flat on it. So
I gave it the same rating. It was also my match of the night. I really loved the dueling brain claw spot.
Yeah.
Where they both have the claw on and they're chopping the shit out of each other. I just like dumb New Japan Never style matches.
Yeah. I mean, this is anyone who likes that kind of style, this will be right up your alley. I mean, they are going to be, I mean, that's exactly what I like too. Like two dudes beating the piss out of each other. So that's what this match was. Match number 4 was a 4-way tag team match. Yukio Sakaguchi and Saki Akai defeat Chris Brooks and Antonio Honda, Don Shoko Dino and Yuki Ino, and Yusuke Okada and Yuya Kuroku when Sakaguchi pins Kuroku with the Don Shoku driver in 9:24. Yeah, Sakaguchi pinned him with the Danjoku driver. So, after last time, when we had the drinks that were left out that turned people into Paulies, this time we saw some more special drinks left out in the open. Sakaguchi and Saki Akai take them.
Vitamin D.
And we see, they just have a big D on them. And we see it's Dino and Ino watching around the corner. Dino and Ino, they drink 2 more of the D bottles as they come out. Ino has matching tights of Dino, and they have more of the bottles with them. But then Saki Akai comes out, and we find out she's been brainwashed by the Dino.
Sakaguchi convinces her to take them. It's like, might be date rape, I don't know.
Yeah, that was pretty funny. So she comes out in Dino's tights, the music had quickly changed to Dino's, and they're telling this weird story where she's like trying to fight off the influence of Dino. Like she nearly goes out in the crowd to get her hands on some random men, but she also looks horrified with herself and she's trying to fight off the influence. So we have to discuss the lore here. First of all, why did the Don Shoku drink not make her gay? Why does she not want women?
Well, you see, because it's, I think it's just that it makes you attracted to men.
I say.
That's why Dino takes it. Like, maybe, I don't know. Saki-sama has a lesbian version of it. I don't
know. Secondly, how the fuck these dudes in the audience managed to act like they were horrified by Saki Akai trying to kiss them and didn't want to be kissed. I mean, they should win an Academy Award, honestly.
I actually I typed a sentence I never thought I'd type in my life. Saki Akai fights her cursed horny hand.
Like, these people in the crowd were like, no, please miss. I'm like, what? I'm like, how are you even doing this? I'm like, they're trying to play along with it because they're supposed to act horrified when Dino wants to kiss them. But, like, this is an actual model who's acting like she wants to, like, jump over the fucking thing and get at you. And these men are managing to actually pretend that they don't want this.
Maybe they're just very afraid of COVID.
And it could be, but they had like smiles on their faces while they're also trying to be like, no, please. So I think they were just going along with it because they thought that's what they're supposed to do. Yeah, and they should win an Academy Award, honestly. I mean,
The masks helped, Charlotte.
They did a great job acting like they did not want this incredibly beautiful woman to kiss them. But yeah, so she's in the Dino corner. She tries to kiss Honda to start. And the Danshoku Akai saga, the Danshoku Akai adventure really goes off from there. She almost goes for Kuroku's penis. She like reaches over, but she pulls her hand back at the last second. And then she just kicks him in the chest repeatedly instead, which, he probably would have liked the first thing better. She almost does the Danshoku nightmare, but she gets stopped by Brooks and Honda. And Honda, again, thank you to DT English Update, DT Pro _ENG. Honda says something like, there are limits, Honda is funny.
I like that the first two-thirds of the match, Brooks and Honda were just trying to stop like anything rapey. Like, they're the baby faces. And then they just kind of give up at the end of it.
Yeah, they're like, okay, look, Danshoku, doing it is one thing, but we cannot have Saki Akai sexually assaulting anybody. Ino goes for the nightmare on Okada, but he also gets cut off by Brooks and Honda, so I guess they were being equal opportunity sexual assault stoppers. And then Saki is left alone with Honda. She grabs the top rope and starts shaking it like she's the Ultimate Warrior.
Yeah, I wrote that too.
Which I was like fucking crying at that point. And she goes crazy and she's about to do the nightmare on him.
This is where Honda, he says there's a limit to what we can do.
Oh, yeah. That's where he says it. Yeah. And he gets out from under the ring and does the Gone the Fox routine.
He does the Gone the Fox in Russian part of it.
Oh, yeah, that's there you go.
Because he keeps going harsho, harsho, and a couple other words I recognize.
We get double asses with Dito and Ino each exposing their butts in opposite corners. Honda and Yuya keep almost sending each other into Dino's backside before he finally does send Dino, or he finally does send, I don't know who in. I wrote that wrong, so it doesn't matter.
I think Kuroko.
Yeah, I think Kuroko finally goes in. I said Dino in, which Dino did not get sent to his own butt. Yukio then comes in the ring, reveals that he has Dino's trunks on underneath as well. He gives Kuroko a big kiss because he's also succumbed to the D drink. And then he sends him into Dino's ass, hits a Danshoku driver on him for the pin. Again, the people who can't handle Danshoku Dino, I get it. But if you can, this was extremely funny. It was one of the best TNT comedy matches I can recall in quite a while. Saki Akai was so excited at the end when she got back in the ring. And I for one, greatly enjoyed the Danshoku Akai adventure. I don't know. Did you like this?
I liked it a lot. I thought it was funny. Although Yukio, like, getting ready to sexually assault someone is terrifying.
It is like, a little less charming than when Danshoku Dino does it. It's like, this is not a man you want to meet in the alley.
Because he's scary looking even if you don't know his background. Yeah.
Yeah. So, it is pretty horrifying. Between matches 4 and 5...
What did you give it?
I usually don't star rate the comedy matches.
Yeah, neither do I.
Yeah. But this is really funny. That's what I give it. Really, really funny.
If you enjoy the humor, you should watch it. If you hate Dino humor, just fast forward.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Dino people who really hate him know that by now. So, it's probably not even worth mentioning. But if you hate Dino, you hate Dino. I'm not going to argue with you. So we just got finished talking about Danshoku Dino. You know what I think Danshoku Dino would tell you? I think more than anybody, Dino would tell you that's very important to keep your best, your men's below the waist grooming in order. So that's why I want to mention right now that support for Wrestling Omakase this week is brought to you by Manscaped. Manscaped offers precision engineered tools for your family jewels. They obsess over the technology developments to provide you with the best tools for your grooming experience. Manscaped is trusted by over 2 million men worldwide. 2 million! It's a lot of men. We have an exclusive offer only for my listeners. 20% off and free shipping with the code OMAKASE at manscaped.com. So again, that's you can get 20% off and free shipping with the code OMAKASE at manscaped.com. Your balls will thank you. That's 20% off, free shipping, manscaped.com. Use code OMAKASE. Unlock your confidence and always use the right tools for the job with Manscaped. In between matches 4 and 5, we got the announcement of the DO. The first night will be November 3rd at Ota War Gym. And they're calling it DO 2021 Part 2. Because remember, they always call
in December, and then they name it for the year they get the shot in January. Yeah.
But now they changed it. So I guess going forward, they're going to be named the year they took place in. I don't know. But yeah, it's a DO 2021 2, which is kind of funny. Match number 5 is Damnation losing to Disaster Box. So Hiroshima, Torawashi, Naomi Yoshimura, and Kazuki Hirata defeat Tetsuya Endo, Soma Takao, Mad Polly, and Nobuhiro Shimatani. Hirata pins Shimatani with the Miracle One-Shot Cradle in 11:51. Hirata tried to attack them all before the bell, but they all just completely ignore him while they're all posing. Just completely, it's not even no-selling, just acting like he's not even there, which is really funny while he's like trying to attack them. But he gets the last laugh because he pins Shimatani with that cradle. I thought this was fine. Some decent stuff. Yoshimura and Polly having another big boy battle. And then probably the highlight was a half-dead Hirata trying to dance after World Ball falling down. That was funny. But I would go 3 stars on this. It was fine.
It was Gilman's 3.
Yeah.
Nomura has to change his hair color, though, because Julia just switched over to the orange motif.
That's true. And
he can't pull it off half as well.
Between matches 5 and 6, we get a match announcement for Peter Pan on August 21st in Kawasaki. A special hardcore tag team match, Mao and Shuma Katsumata versus Chris Brooks and special guest Jun Kasai. That should be awesome.
Shuma's going to get blown up, isn't he?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
So that is in Kawasaki again, outdoors. Match number 6 here, the semi-main event of the show. The Sanakamina team of Yuki Ueno, Shuma Katsumata, and Mao defeated the Jun Retsu team of Jun Akiyama, Makoto Oishi, and Hideki Otani.
I'm still disappointed they're not Jun Goon.
Jun Goon would be a great name. Mao pinned Okitani with the Cannonball 450 at 11:05. You know, this was your pretty typical DET six man. Pretty good. Not that much stood out for me, except for maybe some, particularly fast exchanges down the stretch that were pretty fun. So I went 3.25. Nothing you're going to go out of your way to see here, but it was pretty good.
Yeah, I went 3.25 too. But
at Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
I did like Shunma, like just being a little baby throughout the
whole
match. I think
every match we've had the same rating. We did not tell each other our ratings beforehand.
No, we were off by a quarter star on the first one.
Oh, okay, there you go.
At one point he starts screaming help because Okada, who's Jun Goon's second, keeps telling him he's stupid. complaints to the referee.
That was pretty funny. The main event, the King of DDT 2021 final, Konosuke Takeshita defeats Yuji Hino with the cross-arm German suplex in 1809. So Hino beats the piss out of Takeshita early with chops and etc. He eventually gets a headlock that Takeshita can't get out of. Not the most thrilling action, to be sure.
The Randy Orton special.
They tease that Take is going out, but Hino just kind of weirdly lets him out of it just before the 5-minute call. Take gets his first bit of offense in a while when he puts Hino down with a counter leg lariat. What the hell? I don't know what the hell that was. He ends up jumping right into Hino's arms, though.
It was
kind
Darryl.
Of a hokey. I'm sorry?
It was Daryl.
What was Daryl?
The bell sound. I don't know.
Oh. Yeah. But yeah, he ends up jumping right into his arms, which in kind of a hokey way. It's one of those moves where it's like, what were you even going for other than jump into Hino's arms to get caught in belly to belly suplexed? You know, yeah, which I never liked that.
It was very obviously countered. Like, it wasn't even like a crossbody that could turn into a fallaway slam or something.
Yeah. So Hino puts him right back down at that point. Takeshita fights back with a superplex. Hino gets his foot on the bottom rope, which is weird considering he's taken almost no offense at this point. We get the obligatory elbow exchange, which is pretty decent. They hit each other pretty hard, at least. And then Take rocks Hino with one just before the 10-minute call, keeps pounding him afterward with Hino holding his hands behind his back, I guess, to show how tough he is. They do botch a spot right after that where Takeshita is supposed to sort of sunset flip over Hino and then kick him, but he leaps too far over, so they have to awkwardly repeat the sunset flip setup in a way that looks super fucking fake. Thankfully, everything after this is awesome, though. So Hino comes back with a nice exploder, you know, which I guess is fitting when the prize is a title match without Gamma. And that gets a two count. He goes up top and hits the fucking body press, but Takeshita kicks out again.
Is it actually called the fucking body press?
It definitely is, yeah.
That's fucking awesome.
The fucking body press. Hino goes for the fucking bomb a little later, but Takeshita rounds his way out of it and hits a big running knee just before the 15-minute mark, followed by a second one for a close near fall. Take then hits a German suplex hold for another very close near fall. Hino hits the fucking bomb, but doesn't cover, just leaves Takeshita there looking like he's out of it. I figured that would be his downfall, and it was. He signals a lariat, but Takeshita fights him off with his own lariats, including a huge running lariat that just kills him, but Hino kicks out at one. And then Takeshita ducks another lariat attempt from the enraged Hino, but Hino powers his way free of another German attempt from Takeshita. But Take ducks another lariat attempt, traps his arm to the captive German, and that is the pin. So well, I thought this picked up a ton. After
well, you
the
missed. Left. He also he caught the first lariat, and then Hino's trying to like smash his back with other lariats.
That's
and then
true.
He ducks one of those. Yeah, which I thought was just a really cool way of countering that.
Yeah, this really picked up a lot after the rough start. I can't quite go 4 stars, given how bleh it was early in that major bot spot. So I went 3¾ again here. It's not surprising me Takeshita won, and that sets up him and Akiyama again, with Take likely finally getting his win back on August 21st at Peter Pan and Kawasaki.
I really like the match, but I think it was kind of obvious they're going to do Takeshita versus Akiyama. Because, you know, who else are they going to do?
Mm-hmm.
And no,
I saw some people upset about it. I'm like, well, who else is there?
I would have liked Taguchi.
They did him already, though.
You could have him like make a comeback and make him a new ace because he's the beefiest boy.
I don't know.
I mean, Hino's there, but
I never thought they were going to do Higuchi.
No, I didn't either.
Maybe outside chance Sasaki or
Endo, maybe, but...
or well, from the final four, I mean, maybe Sasaki or Hino. Yeah. But I figured it was Takeshita.
I figured it wasn't going to be Hino. I thought, Takeshita was kind of like. Whatever, it was a good match. I went 3¾, too. Everyone else in cage match thought it was the match of the night, but they were wrong because they're mutants.
Yeah, there you go. It does seem to have the highest rating on Grapple so far, too, but it's like a sample size of 5 people, so.
No, cage match is like 24, I think.
I'm talking about Grapple.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, there you go. That is your DDT, King and DDT final review. Good show. Nothing that's going to blow your mind, but all three of the King of DDT matches are well worth watching, and the 4-way tag is worth watching if you're into the DDT comedy. The rest of the card, very skippable, but those 4 matches, I think, are, very worth watching.
It was nice to see Yatsu win.
Yeah. But there you go. That's your those are your King of DDT matches. And we'll have to see what happens in Kawasaki. That is on August 21st. So that'll be fun.
I hope they get Onita for that too.
What did Saki Akai tweet that somebody retweeted? I want to see this. People like are drawing her as John Sugar Tea now.
That's awesome. I mean, it's horrifying because, well, look at Saki Akai and look at Dan Sakardino.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah. What is it? Oh, because of a mysterious drink, weird family has been created. And it's a photo of her with Eno, Yu-Gi-Oh, and Dino. Yeah. That is a mysterious drink indeed. Okay. So the second show we're here to talk about is the Gleet version 1. Which is their official first show, even though they've had other shows before
that. They've had like 8 shows.
Yeah, I haven't watched any of those pre-first show.
I haven't seen anything from Gleet either.
Yeah, so this is my first exposure to them. And this was at Tokyo Dome City Hall, July 1st, 2021. Now, if you don't know anything about Gleet, I will try my best to explain this. They are the new company formed by Ledet, who's the company that used to own Pro Wrestling Noah, before they sold it to Cyber Agent. There's a lot of crossover with Wrestle One. You know, Kasayashi is involved.
That's a live event promotion company for people wondering. They do concerts and they do production for, like, I guess, fights too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so they have like a lot of Wrestle One connections here with the Strong Hearts guys are signed. Kasayashi is, you know, a big part of this.
Takanori Ito, I think.
Ito, Minoru Tanaka.
Soma Watanabe, who is the former Picasso Illuminar.
So a lot of guys here with Wrestle One ties. And, you know, they don't have a big roster, really. So like, there's a lot of guys who are a lot of outsiders being used, which we'll get into. And they're doing basically a format where they're doing both what they call G Pro Wrestling, which is traditional pro wrestling rules, and Ledet UWF, which are a variation on the traditional UWF rules, which are, you know, if you don't know anything about UWF, that's the, you know, very shoot fighting-esque company from the started in the mid-80s, and there were a million offshoots, which would take so long to explain, it would take up.
Basically, mid-80s died for a couple of years, late-80s died after a couple of years, UWFI jobbed to New Japan.
Yeah. That's the really, really, really cliff notes. But like, you know, UWF, when the second UWF split, you basically get Pancrase out of that because one of the companies that came out of that split was Fujiwara Gumi, and then Masakatsu Funaki and Minoru Suzuki.
And Ken Shamrock.
And Ken Shamrock leave to form Pancrase. So you get like an actual shoot fighting organization out of that. And then what the hell was. Oh, and then Rings was the other one.
And Rings became a shoot fighting
organization. Rings became a shoot fighting organization, yeah. So basically, the second UWF splits three ways, two of them become actual MMA companies. And then only UWFI is kind of
saved. UWFI becomes Kingdom.
UWFI becomes Kingdom, and then Kingdom becomes Pride. So really all three of them eventually become shoot fighting organizations. But yeah, you know, it's been kind of a dead style for a while, but companies always try to, you know, there are a lot of companies that try to revive it. And, you know, we'll go into that when we get to it, because this show is split up in two halves. Yes. So like the first four matches are all traditional pro wrestling, and the last four matches are UWF rules. So we'll talk about their UWF rules and how they differ from the traditional ones in a second. So this show opens up with a big pre-show segment. By the way, this show was on YouTube. It's no longer on YouTube.
It's coming back in a couple of days, though.
Yeah, it's coming back in like a week, I think.
July 15th.
July 15th. So, like 10 days. So, you know, Gleet puts up a lot of their shows on their official YouTube for free. So that's great, obviously, if you want to know how to watch them. They took them down for 10. They took this one down for 10 days because it's about to air on Samurai TV in Japan. So I guess that's part of the deal with Samurai is they can't have it on free TV during a certain time span. But yeah, so if you want to watch Gleet, check their YouTube. It's in like other places too right now. Like what Bilibili has it, you said, right?
Bilibili, Youku, and VK all have it.
Yeah, so like if you know where to look for like illegal Japanese wrestling streams, they're all up there. This is all up on all those. But if you don't want to deal with that, you can wait 10 days and watch it on YouTube. So.
I watched it illegally.
Okay, I watched it on the official YouTube. Well, so, because it's great to stream it through my TV. So very easy.
The YouTube app on Roku kind of sucks. So.
I use it all the time. I have no problem with it. It doesn't, anyway. So this show opens up with a pre-show segment with everyone and every match being introduced and coming out to like do a little pose. I thought that's a very cool way to differentiate themselves from other companies, which has to be a goal here, right? Like you, okay. Like everybody's been talking, I guess, a lot about whether this promotion has any long-term future. And I totally get why people say no, because it's, first of all, it's backed by Ladette, who obviously have not exactly had a sterling track record with Noah. They had to sell it, you know, didn't have the funds.
They only had it for a year, right?
I think they only had it for a year, yeah.
Yeah, because they got it from Astabee.
It's run by Kaz Hayashi, who used to run Wrestle 1, which didn't succeed either. Although it's not like that died in like 2 years. Like people act like Wrestle 1 was around for a second. It's around for like 9 years or something, I think.
I think right? Wrestle 1, 7 years? 2013 to 2020.
All right, 7 years. It's still a pretty long time.
And the first 3 years, Muda was actually running it, so I blame Muda as much as anyone.
I get all this. Like it's a bunch of people who, you know, aren't known for long-term promotions. So I get that. But if they're going to survive, like what the goal has to be, we have to present a promotion that is different from what everybody else is doing. We can't just be another medium-sized indie putting on wrestling. Like you can't just be another All Japan, can't be another Big Japan. You have to, I mean, Big Japan differentiates itself too with the death match.
Really can't be another Wrestle 1.
Really can't be another Wrestle 1. So what they're trying to do is they have a very different presentation. It is very sports-like. And, you know, they have this half UWF thing to really try to stand out. And they're doing women's matches too, which is also, I mean, Wrestle 1 did that, but now you got women's matches with UWF rules too, which I thought was really cool. And, you know, they're doing a lot of stuff that hopefully will help them stand out and look different from other promotions. I mean, watching this show, I guess spoiling my thoughts on it, it definitely made me want to watch more Gleet. So that's a great thing too. Other thing we should mention too is the fucking name. So
do we have to?
I'm saying Gleet. They say great if you listen to the show. It's because L and R is the same thing in Japanese. It really just...
It's not racist, though. They're doing it on purpose, but I still feel weird doing it.
I feel weird saying great, but they're doing it on purpose because like they're replacing the R with the L for Ladette. That's for
I also get great joy from saying the word Gleet.
Yeah, Gleet is always just more fun to say. But yes, if you watch the show and you're like, they say great constantly. I'm like, yes, they do. That's what they're saying. But, you know, it's spelled like Gleet.
It's the most fun thing to say in wrestling. It's Master Watto.
It is just a fun thing to say out loud. So I'm going to continue saying Gleet.
Gleet.
Gleet. So the opener here, so remember, the first half of the show is all the pro wrestling stuff.
Gleet Pro Wrestle, yeah.
Yeah. So the opener was from Strong Hearts and obviously now signed with Gleet. Because most of the Strong Hearts guys are signed with Gleet. There is one Strong Hearts wrestler on this show that is not, which I'll get to in a second. But yes, the opener here, El Lindemann defeating Hayato Tamura and 827. So Hayato Tamura, he's a just tap out guy. He actually started all the way back in 2015 with Hard Hit when he did one match for them. But then he did not wrestle again until he started with Taka in 2019, according to Cage Match.
And then he was 0-1 champion less than a year later.
Then he was 0-1 champion less than a year. He's not still, is he?
No, he lost it to Tanaka.
Okay. So, yeah, he's been wrestling a lot for 0-1 this year, which I guess makes sense since he was champion. 21 matches total in 0-1. And Lindemann, of course, is from Strong Hearts and signed.
And the 0-1 junior heavyweight champion.
Oh, yeah, there you go. I don't watch 0-1 at all, so I'm glad you...
Neither do I, but those are the two belts he's carrying to the ring because it's a two-belt title.
Yeah, I totally forgot about that. But yeah, so Lindemann, of course, from Strong Hearts and signed with the company. Tamura's not signed with the company, so he's still freelance. Tamura, like most everyone else on Earth, a lot bigger than Lindemann, and it really stands out when they go face-to-face at the start. Lindemann does these like really quick set of backdrop suplexes, followed by a snap German after ducking a Tamura lariat. That looked really cool. He tries that judo throw that he does right after that. After a brief struggle, he does finally get him over, which always looks impressive because of the size difference. But Tamura does kick out. But finally, Lindemann finishes him off with another German for the win. Really fun opener here. I would go 3.5 stars, all action.
I went 3.25. This is only Hayato's like 52nd match.
Wow, that's
really good. He got really good really quick.
Yeah.
And now, and Lindemann, of course, is like adorably short. Do you watch, have you ever seen Adventure Time?
Like a few episodes.
Oh, there's a one where he's having a where Finn is having a flashback and he starts singing a song. It's like, I'm a buff baby, I can dance like a man. And whenever I see Ellen Dimon, I just hear in my head, I'm a buff baby.
There you go. Match number two, Kyoko Inoue defeats Michiko Miyagi in 6:29. So a note, Inoue here, she's currently from Diana. She's also 52 years old. She goes all the way back to All Japan Women's in 1990. Miyagi is the former Cassandra / Andress. She previously wrestled under those names for Sendai Girls and Stardom. Lately, she's been mostly wrestling for Actress Girls and the Joshi promotion. But apparently she's signed with Gleet, as the graphic informs me. So, and she's not doing any kind of demon gimmick here. She's just a girl. Michiko Miyagi.
I kind of missed a demon gimmick.
I'm sure she's probably got tired of doing it after a while. It's like after so many years of doing it, you know, even Undertaker had to go to the biker. It's like, you know, she probably just got tired of being a demon.
Don't compare her to the Undertaker. She's not a white supremacist.
That's true. Well, as far as we know, there are some Asian white supremacists, unfortunately.
That's so terrifying. I know.
They fucking Andy.
Isn't Honda in one of those cults?
I think he is, actually. Yeah, Andy. I was thinking of that Andy fucking guy, Andy Ngo or whatever, who fucking follows around Antifa and is like, look at them. They're doing stuff. That guy's clearly like, and I think he turned out he worked with the Proud Boys or something. I'm like, you know, you're not white, sir. You're not actually white. Anyway, but there's nothing wrong with this match. There also wasn't much to it. Inoue puts Miyagi away fairly quickly with a powerbomb for the win. I went 2 3/4. Not much to recommend here, but it was all right.
That was my rating too, and I would have liked to see like them. I guess Kyoko's limited, but I like Miyagi. I would have liked to actually see her do something.
Yeah, she didn't really get the chance to do much of anything here.
It was almost a squash.
Yeah. Match number three, the six-man tag team match, Strong Hearts, Shima Issei Onitsuka, and Shigehiro Irie defeated Kazayashi, Keiichi Sato, and Soma Watanabe in 11:44. So let's go over the wrestlers here. Keiichi Sato, he is a longtime freelancer. He wrestled a lot for All Japan in 2016 through 19. Lately, he's been showing up most often in Kaliga Pro Wrestling.
Wasn't he a sweeper for like
2 seconds, I think. Yeah. Watanabe is an ex-Wrestle 1 guy who's now signed with Gleet.
Pegaso Illuminar.
I'm sorry?
He used to be Pegaso Illuminar for your Wrestle 1 fans. Yeah.
And Sato is still a freelancer, by the way.
Yeah.
Onitsuka and Shima are both Gleet / Stronghearts, while Irie is just Stronghearts. So there you go. Apparently he hasn't signed with them. Onitsuka, I don't know where he came from. He's like been with Shima for a while now. I think he came up through OWE, I think.
Yeah, no, he's one of the OWE guys, but he's not Chinese, is he?
He's not Chinese, yeah.
So I guess he was a Dragon Gate guy that they poached or something when he was still in the dojo.
There's a big spot here where the Strong Hearts team stacks everybody up and then all kind of splash down on top of them, eventually on each other, ending with Irie. That was a little too hokey for me, too goofy. Didn't really love that spot. Things did pick up a lot, though, when the dive started. The crowd was really most impressed by Irie's crossbody to a seated opponent on the apron, which sent them both all the way out to the floor. You know, that he's a big dude, so I get why that's
he is a very large man. It's weird to see him do anything.
But that was really cool. That was really cool. But all the other dives are great too, though. There was one awkward spot where Shima like turned around a little too soon or something and had to just stand there while Watanabe like actually set himself to hit a springboard dropkick. But for the most part, the action after all the dives was really fun. And Onitsuka ends up pinning Kaz Hayashi with a standing Rana. That was obviously a big upset, and they were going crazy about it afterwards. And Kaz even challenged him to a one-on-one match, just using his fingers. He's like, you and me one-on-one. So I guess that'll be coming up on a future Gleet show. But yeah, this had its rough parts, but really picked up a ton by the end. I will go 3.5 stars on it. It was pretty fun by the end of the match.
I'm not a Dragon Gate guy, but I think I liked it a little more than you. I went 3 3/4. Mm-hmm. And one note is both Shima and Kaz are WCW guys.
That's true. Yeah.
That's so weird.
It is kind of weird. But yeah, that's the Gleet. That's Gleet's maybe something coming up next. So that could be on the next G Pro Wrestling show, which is July 25th. Weirdly, they don't have anything left for UWF. They don't have anything coming up for the UWF part. It's kind of interesting. but I'll have to get into that, I guess, in a second. Anyway, back to this show. So the main event of the pro wrestling half was Ryuichi Kawakami defeating T-Hawk in 1726. So Kawakami, of course, he's an ex-Big Japan guy who moved over to Gleet and became a full-time Gleet roster member. He's a very interesting guy on this roster because, first of all, he's one of the few full-time roster members who doesn't have any, on the pro wrestling side, who doesn't have any connection to Wrestle One or Strong Hearts. You know, he came over from Big Japan. And he's someone I want to see, you know, do well here because I've always really liked him in Big Japan. I think they wasted him. They never used him to do anything.
He had that like little run with Kakuta where they won the All Asian belts and then lost him like a month later on All Japan show. But he was mostly like an undercard tag guy, right?
Yeah. I mean, he never did anything in that company. I mean, he had a few strong title challenges, I guess, but I don't know. They never seemed to want to use him beyond a certain level. And it's bizarre for a company that has, you know, it's like, okay, if Kawakami was in New Japan and he was stuck behind a bunch of guys, it's like, okay, he's in fucking Big Japan. I'm like, there is no depth at all in the strong division. Maybe give the guy a fucking shot at least. And they never wanted to, really. It was really awesome in those All Asia title matches you just talked about.
They gave Daichi Hashimoto a chance, and that was like the one guy who debuted after 2010 that was allowed to hold the belt.
Yeah, and it's just and that actually was a pretty fun reign. So I don't know why you wouldn't give some younger guys. I mean, his last reign was pretty fun, not the first one.
No, the first one sucked.
Yeah, the first one sucked. But I don't know. It's such a weird company, so there's no point in really trying to figure out the booking. But yeah, it's cool to see him here in Gleet, and I hope they run with him, which, you know, he did win here, so maybe they're going to. But yeah, this match was pretty standard stuff for a while, really hard chops and such, until we get a dive that goes kind of horribly wrong. T-Hawk is trying to hit a standard tope to Kawakami on the outside, but he way overshoots his target and barely connects with Kawakami. Really, just his arm hit into his head as he's flying by.
He fractured a bunch of ribs.
Oh, did he really? I didn't even hear about that.
He fractured two ribs, I think.
He crashed in the railing hard, so I'm not surprised. But yeah, it makes the rest of his match even more impressive because this was, I mean, this match ended up being awesome. You know, it was really hard hitting, a lot of cool head drops and such. Featured the right guy winning, as far as I'm concerned. Kawakami hit that fireman's carry into Michinoku driver thing he does for the pin.
I think it's called the Hurricane Driver.
There you go. I think this was was it named after the Storm, the WWE wrestler, the hockey team, or the alcoholic drink?
Maybe he really likes the Scorpions.
There you go. There's another one. It could be any of that.
The Japanese like a lot of bad American hard rock.
That is true. They definitely do. But yeah, so this to me was the first 4-star match I've ever seen from Gleet. They beat the piss out of each other, had a pretty awesome match, so I went 4 flat. I really enjoyed this.
I did too, and I wrote them down, so I'm not just copying it.
But yeah, that was an awesome match. Anything else you want to say about this one?
No, I just thought it was great. I mean, no, that... what was it? That tope was horrifying.
Yeah,
the tope. Like, I knew he broke his ribs before I saw the match, and then I saw it, and I was like, oh, yeah.
Of course. Basically. So that does it for the pro wrestling half. So now all the remaining matches are under Gleet UWF rules. So let me explain how this works. So the original UWF, okay, or yes, by the original UWF, in a singles match, each wrestler would start a match with 15 points. They would lose different number of points. I don't remember exactly how much for you having to use the ropes to get a rope break, being knocked down. I think the knockdown was the most point loss. I think there was like 5. Whereas, like, the role player was only 1. Or being at a disadvantage in a hold, which was, like, the most, what's it called?
It's the hardest to quantify.
The hardest to quantify, yeah. And I think that one was, like, 5.
That was 3, I think.
Oh, 3?
Okay. I think they're 1, 3, 5, but I can't remember.
I think that sounds right. That sounds right. Yeah. But they've... So that was the hardest to quantify. So I never had any... I'm like, oh, he lost 3 points because, he was in a disadvantage in a hold, I guess. So... It did not have pinfalls. The UWFI towards the very end did have pinfalls, mostly because they were doing a lot of intermotional stuff at New Japan, and you know they wanted to let these guys get pins, I guess, instead of having to do knockouts or submissions. But for the most part, it's knockout, submission, or if you lose all your points, you lose. Now, the Ledette version, they have simplified this a lot. And oh, I should mention too, each wrestler started with 15 points, tag team started with 21 points, and for the rare six-man tag, they started with 30 points. So, you know, the point values went up depending on how many people were in the match. Ledette simplified this a lot. No matter what type of match it is, singles or tag, both teams or both wrestlers start up with 5 points. If they had to take a rope break, they lose a point. If they get knocked down, they lose a point. There's no more submission disadvantage thing. So it's just those two things.
Well, I think it's if you get knocked down enough for the ref to start counting. Like you can just, you can take
a knockdown. Yes. So that's what a knockdown is called. So I should have specified. Like you can get, if you just get like knocked down or suplex or something and get right back up, then it's not a knockdown. But if you like can't get up right away from a kick or
if the ref starts the 10 count,
yeah, then you, that counts as a knockdown and you lose a point. So if you run out of points, you know, if you get knocked down or have to get a rope break 5 times, you lose the match. So that is how the UWF rules work in Gleet, which I don't mind that simplification at all. I think it kind of makes a lot of sense, you know? So I don't know how you feel about it, but I think it's...
I like it because you could actually follow what's going on.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to follow. And they have the graphics there to remind you what the total is, which I always like. So, you know. So now that we've explained the rules, the first UWF rules match was a tag team match. Dajiro Matsui and Tetsuya Izuchi.
Matsui had a very interesting career.
Yeah, we'll get that.
Sorry about that.
It's okay. They defeat Minoru Tanaka and Sumu Watanabe in 8:57. So, Watanabe, we went over. He's pulling double duty here. Minoru Tanaka should be well known to most of you. He also signed with Gleet here, so he's a Gleet wrestler. And, you know, he's a guy, obviously, goes way back to New Japan and Battle Arts. And, you know, he had a lot of experience with the shoot style, in other words. He was most recently in NOAH, I guess. But here he is in Gleet. I think he signed, right? He signed with Gleet.
He was like junior tag champion last year for like 15 seconds, or 2 years ago.
And why don't so you're all raring to go here from Matt Siri. He's
48
years old.
I'm not raring to go.
Go ahead, tell me about it.
He started off in UWFI. He had like 3 matches, six. Then he went to Kingdom with Sakuraba.
So nobody knows what Kingdom is, so let's explain that. Kingdom was the UWFI follow-up after UWFI went out of business from the New Japan feud. And it lasted like what? Only, I think, a year and a half or something?
It was like closer to 3, I think.
Oh, okay. Well, it didn't last that long.
Sakuraba got into UFC because they tried to get press for Kingdom.
Yeah, and then they basically fold it into Pride. Yeah. So Pride takes over for Kingdom. And their logo looks like the Xbox logo. I don't know. I mean, like, every time we see it on Cage Match, I'm like, why did Xbox want a promotion? But yeah, Matsui also did Battle Arts. He did IGF.
He did very bad MMA. 12, 25, and 7.
There you go. He hasn't really been active since 2015, so he's basically coming out of retirement for this.
He only had 18 matches like a decade before that.
Yeah, so not a guy who wrestles a ton, but, you know. Izuchi, he's a heat-up guy. The only non-Gleet signed wrestler in this match.
And Matsui also kind of looks like he should be Great Okan's dad. That was my, one takeaway from that.
There you go. So both teams used the ropes to escape a hold early on, so we end up at 4-4 relatively quickly. Tanaka then escapes another one, I think a triangle, against Izuchi to go down 4-3. Watanabe has to escape a cross arm breaker from Matsui with the ropes. That puts their team down 4-2. But then he manages to knock Matsui down almost right after with a nice spinning back kick that just hits him right in the gut that he just like collapses on. I mean, I like that a lot because it's like it shows a knockdown doesn't have to be a head kick, you know? And that made it 3-2 at that point. But then Matsui soon after taps out Watanabe almost immediately with a Kimura to give his team a win. And I thought this match was a great start for the UWF rules in Gleet. I mean, this is exactly what I was hoping for out of this style. Fast mat work, fast striking, no laying around on the mat for hours in the fucking guard like you see in shoot style matches sometimes. I went 3.75 on this. Really enjoyed it.
I went 3.5. I do really like it, though.
Anything else you want to note from the match?
No, not really. It was fun, but it was short, right? It was like 9 minutes.
Yeah, it's a lot hard to talk about, yeah. As a lot of UWF rules matches will often be, so, you know. Match number 6, also, I guess I can stop saying, every match from here on out is UWF rules. This was the UWF rules Joshi match, which I thought was interesting. So Chihiro Hashimoto defeated Maya Fukuda in 450. Now, Hashimoto, she's the Sendai Girls ace. She's been their world champion since October 2019 in her fifth reign with the belt. Very few title defenses, though, because Sendai Girls does not really run much at all during the pandemic.
Doesn't Hashimoto have, like, every other reign?
I think so.
I mean, there have been nine reigns and she has five.
I mean, she is a you know, this little tank. I say little. She's a short tank. She's very similar body to, what's her name? And Jordynne Grace and Grace and Impact.
They had actually had a great match together like 3 years ago on Sunday.
Yeah. So like, you know, short little tank, big muscular body. And like, you know, she has that amateur wrestling background and she can just toss people around. I mean, she makes total sense for the ace of a Joshi company. I mean, she looks like an ace, honestly.
She's an indie tag team with you formerly from TJPW.
Yeah.
What's it? 200 kilograms?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yes, they're deadlift. So
yeah. Maya, on the other hand, she's only 20 years old. She's from something called Actoring. Now, it was really, really difficult to find anything about Actoring. There's nothing in English at all. I did find some Japanese sources, which I had to try to read, which, you know, is always difficult for me. From as far as I can tell, I did get a little bit of help from Flupke, who's Luke, who's been on this show before. And basically, I went to him and I was like, am I reading this right? And he was like, yes. So, Actoring is a spinoff of Actress Girls. It's a, like, what they call it basically translates to their performance art.
Is that spin-off. Where Arisa Hoshiki is doing matches now?
I think, maybe.
Okay.
I don't know. Maybe, I actually don't know. Maybe you're right. But yeah, they describe it as, you know, stage performance. That's what it's described as. So, you know, there's matches, but the matches sometimes have like monologues in the middle of them.
So it's WWE. It's Roman Reigns.
There you go. I mean, I think it's probably actually closer to like Makai, you know, which Hikaru Shida does obviously when she's in Japan. But yeah, the roster is made up of a mix of, you know, Actress Girls regulars and different gimmicks, Actress Girls regulars appearing as themselves. And then these rookies who haven't appeared in the main promotion yet, but they're clearly being trained in the same dojo. And that's almost verbatim what Luke said. So I'll give him credit for that. But yes, this is a very different kind of, you know, style and presentation. But, you know, and Fukuda is one of these rookies that hasn't actually debuted in Actress Girls yet. Has only been in Actoring. But there you go. It's like it's a stage performance spinoff of Actress Girls.
Fukuda just looks like someone Ross Yogao would want to sign.
Yeah, pretty much.
She looks like blonde Hanakamura. I
mean, yeah.
My immediate reaction was like, Rossi's going to just fucking see this show and pull up.
He's going to be pulling up, that is for sure. But yeah, so Chihiro has a huge size advantage on the skinny Fukuda to the point where the match almost looks absurd. She gets a half crab on her pretty much immediately, which causes her to have to use a rope break. She then gets an ankle lock right after that, causing her to use another rope.
That was a vicious Boston Crab, though. I wrote U-style Boston Crab.
U-style Boston Crab. People don't know, U-style is what people refer to UWF style promotion as. I think there is a promotion called U-style, too.
Yeah, there might be.
And then
I don't know if it's still around.
Yeah. I think it is. And then Chihiro just throws her around with a big gut-wrench suplex. But Maya then fights back. She gets some strikes, but Chihiro completely no-sells all of them. Like, just does not sell a single thing. But finally, a high kick does stun Chihiro and knock her back. But then Chihiro immediately grabs her and slams her down hard. That leads to a knockout tease. Maya recovers, but then Chihiro immediately applies the ankle lock again and gets her to tap out. So this was basically a squash, but it was a fun squash. So I went 3 stars on it. Chihiro was great at dominating the match, unsurprisingly. And I thought Maya was a pretty good underdog as well. So.
I went 3-2. It was almost like a prison beatdown or something. It was. Did you notice, like, after the two consecutive submissions, they just cut to Tamura? Kiyoshi Tamura is like the Kaz Hayashi, but for the U style, and he's just disappointed in her.
I know. So Tamura was, what, he comes from Rings, right?
He's the Rings guy. He came from UWF, but he's the guy who's in charge of the U style.
Yeah. So he's a. I think, because I've seen a lot of him in Rings. I don't remember seeing a lot of him in UWF, but maybe I'm...
Well, he started Rings. I don't remember where he came from.
Okay. But didn't he... No, Maeda started Rings.
Oh, no. Then what am I thinking of?
Yeah, Maeda started Rings.
Maeda, but okay, Tamura was like the ace of Rings.
Tamura was like the ace of Rings.
Yeah, I just got it. Tamura, Maeda confused. Yeah.
Okay, so he did wrestle in UWF Easter. Yeah, he was in UWFI. I don't know what I'm thinking of. Yeah, he was in UWFI from 91 to 96.
He's the guy in the red tracksuit that they kept cutting to, just stern in the crowd.
Yeah, he got really upset with... so it looks like he got upset when Vader was in UWFI, basically. And that's kind of how he ended up jumping to rings. So, but yeah, he just kind of became the... remember that U-Style thing I mentioned? I thought that was promotion. He founded that. So okay. he was the founder of U-Style. There you go.
Yeah, no, he's like the booker for the Euclid.
Yeah, which makes sense.
WF,
obviously makes sense for that role, so... then we have, I should mention too, the other thing I wanted to mention is, Chihiro was awesome here, and I really want to see more of her in UWF style matches. That was really fun.
I just like seeing Chihiro wherever she pops up. She's so much fun.
Yeah. Semi-main event, Masakatsu Funaki defeats Yu Izuka in 7:58. Funaki really needs no introduction, I think. He's a freelance guy. But he obviously was one of the founders of Pancrase. Been doing all this stuff forever, just great at it.
A dojo made of Minoru Suzuki.
Yeah. Izuka comes from Heat Up, where he's been wrestling since 2016, but he's now signed with Gleet, so he's jumped over there. This is a little slower paced than the earlier UWF rules matches, a lot more laying around, especially early. Izuka ends up having to get the first rope break from a Fujiwara armbar attempt from Funaki early on. Funaki gets a knockdown and a high kick. It looks like it hit Izuka's arm more than anything, but I guess the idea was the kick was so forceful, it still knocked him down. Funaki then tried to follow up with a quick barrage of strikes, but Izuka uses the opening to get a nice armbar takedown. That results in Funaki having to get the ropes.
Yeah, the old Nakamura-style floating armbar, like when you just cast a lariat.
That was really cool. Yeah. And that made it 4-3 at that point. And we get things really pick up from there, some fun striking. Izuka, though, gets dropped by a capo kick from Funaki, which makes it 4-2 now. Funaki quickly applies a sleeper hold from behind, and Izuka has no choice but to tap, so that is the end. A little dull early, but had a hot finishing sequence at least, so I decided to go 3.25.
I went 3.5. I liked it a little more.
What'd you like about it?
I just liked how fast it got towards the end. There's something about it where it felt organic, and I was amused. Also, at the end, with Izuka being dead on the map, I had to scrape him up.
Yeah,
but that didn't affect the rating. I just kind of liked.
Yeah. Funaki dominated for the most part, which certainly makes sense. But Izuka got to show a little fire and some pushback, too, at least. Definitely more than my Fukuda got to show in the last match, that is for sure. The main event, and I think the reason why a lot of people may have paid attention to this, Sho defeated Takanori Ito by referee decision in 16:17. So this match, obvious show as in, yes, the New Japan Pro Wrestling show, the one half or Punky 3K. I'm trying to remember the last time a New Japan wrestler, like contracted wrestler, not even like a freelancer like Suzuki, appeared on a freelance show. It has to be like, I would imagine it would be when they were still working with Taka.
Would the Baba Memorial stuff count?
Oh, you're right. That would count. That was pretty recent.
Yeah, that was this year.
If you want to count like an actual promotion, then it would probably be like when Kaientai Dojo, when Taka was still there.
And Kojima did the All Japan match in 2017. I remember that.
I think
where he killed Tuama.
Yeah, someone must have worked Kaientai Dojo in 2018, though. That'd probably be the last one. But it's been a little while. So, you know, the Joe Lanza went into all that stuff on the Voice Wrestling flagship Patreon. I'm not going to steal his, steal his scoop. So you can check that Patreon out if you want to hear about the circumstances behind this. But basically, it comes down to Dick Togo. So there you go. Ito is, of course, the Wrestle One guy. He kind of had a Kevin Owens lookalike thing going on for a long time. He is, of course, also Simon Gleet. And, you know, I think he's doing both pro wrestling and UWF stuff. So, you know, he was pretty good at both of them, I think. Ito and Sho, they spend a lot of time fighting over a leg lock on the mat at first. Not terribly interesting, honestly. But then the way they transition from that to the guard was kind of neat. And they do stand up pretty quickly after that. The first rope break comes when Sho gets a cross arm breaker on Ito, which forces Ito to quickly make the ropes. That makes it 5-4 Sho. A Kimura from Sho again sees Ito need to use a rope break, which makes it 5-3. But Ito then catches Sho with this sick counter knee to the face, as he's in the middle of trying for a takedown. Basically the same shoot knee that like killed Nakamura in that, you know, in the shoot fight. So I feel like that's been a spot in these pro in these shoot style wrestling matches forever because of that famous moment. But yeah, that leads to a huge leaping spine buster from Ito.
And they also do it in the Sakuraba match in Wrestle Kingdom.
Yeah. There's a reference to that, yeah.
Which I feel like more people probably saw than like in the style matches.
That's probably true.
Yes.
So if people have seen that, that it's the same knee. But yeah, that's what that was a tribute to. It was a tribute to the shoe fire. Show makes the ropes on the half crab, so it's now 4-3. Great sequence there. We get our first knockdown tease. Ito hits a big German suplex right after slamming his way out of the armbar. Show does get back up, but the points are now 3-3. Ito starts just laying into Show with slaps to the face, leading into a really energetic sequence. And the striking on display here is really great. Ito just starts screaming right in Show's face for good measure. Show that finally goes behind Ito to put a stop to that, and then he takes him down to the mat from there. But Ito is able to stand back up before Show can really get any kind of hold on. So they're back to slapping each other, and then Ito hits a hard high kick that just drops Show for another knockdown. That makes it 3-2 Ito now.
That got an 8 count, actually.
Yeah, it was pretty close. The moment Show gets back up, Ito charges with a leaping knee and keeps up with the striking. But Show finally catches his leg, hits his own slaps, a lariat to the face, and then a German suplex. Then he like kind of rolls back like he's going to do the rolling German, but then instead does a takedown straight into an armbar that looks really cool. Ito tries to slam his way out again by lifting Show, but this time he can't do it, and the referee stops the match. So this was an awesome main event. I went 4 stars flat on this as well. Both guys just beat the piss out of each other here in between some really nice mat work. So there you go.
I went 4.25. I do really appreciate that Ito actually had the point advantage going in.
Yeah.
Because all the other three prior, I don't know about on the show at least. I don't know about the other UWF Ledet matches, or UWF Gleet matches, sorry, if that ever happens. I do like the idea. Oh, because I didn't think Show was going to get tapped. I thought he might lose on points. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I could see maybe New Japan allowing that. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So I legitimately fell for, oh, he might win. He might lose.
Yeah.
He might win.
But instead, Show did win by referee stoppage. Overall, I thought this was a very fun show. And I definitely think I'll keep up with Gleet from here. It's like, it feels like an antidote to so much of wrestling right now, even a lot of Japanese wrestling in this form, because it's like there's no bullshit at all. There's really not even any storylines. It's just straight ahead wrestling. Bunch of matches, bunch of good matches, and like, you know, the UWF style is completely different from what other people are doing right now. And even the pro wrestling matches, like the atmosphere and the presentation just feels very different. And, you know, I think it's a great start, and, you know, it's definitely something I'm going to keep up with. So
I think even the UWF matches from match to match were different enough, because you had like the tag match, you had that women's match that was barely a match, you had the rookie match against the Funaki. So I think it was like 8 different matches. It didn't feel like you were just watching the same 4 undercard matches.
Yeah, that's a good point. Like,
where it's just the same 6, 8, and 10 man tag.
Exactly. So the upcoming UWF, or not UWF, the upcoming Gleet shows, they're both G Pro Wrestling. So we have G Pro Wrestling version 1 that is on July 25th on Sunday, which is from Osaka in the Azuria Taisho Hall, which is the smaller building in Osaka for sure. And then the second show is Wednesday, October 4th for G Pro Wrestling version 2 from Shinjuku Face. Again, a smaller venue, although I find it interesting they're booking the much nicer and much more expensive Shinjuku Face than Shingiba.
Taisho Hall is also very nice looking too.
Yeah. So that's Wednesday, August 4th. So that's G Pro Wrestling version 2. And there's no cards yet for either show. So we will have to see, what those shows look like. But they're, you know, no UWF style matches in those two, it seems like. It seems like these are going to be just the pro wrestling style matches. And we'll have to wait and see, what else is coming up as far as, like, you know, any other kind of matches, any other UWF matches. But, I mean, I honestly came away from this card more excited about the UWF stuff than anything. So I kind of wish there was some UWF style shows coming up, but, you know, it seems like they're doing the pro wrestling first. So we'll have to wait and see. No, did you you come away thinking you want to watch more Gleet?
At least the UWF Gleet. But no, I bet I enjoyed the pro wrestling, but I don't think I think the smaller shows I'm not going to follow as much. But like something like this where it was like fun four and four that I'm definitely going to watch.
There you go. All right, so we can wrap this episode up. Anything you want to plug, Devin?
I don't know. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at More Than Meat Joy.
Okay. Of course, you can follow us on Twitter at Wrestle Omakase.
Wrestling Wouldn't Fit.
No, Wouldn't Fit. You're the first person ever tried to steal that line from me.
I'm disappointed the Patreon isn't Wrestle Omakase.
It should be, probably. But yes, so you can, like I said, follow us on Twitter. You can sign up for the Patreon at patreon.com/wrestlingomakase. It's, like I said, a lot of fun, a lot of cool stuff coming up, including next week's episode, where I will be joined by a guest that I haven't set up yet, but to review the New Japan Summer Struggle in Sapporo shows, which is my first New Japan watching and reviewing in a while. So, you know, be fun to try to jump back in and see what they've been up to.
You'll get a big Tai Chi main event.
That is true. I'm very excited for the Dangerous Techers against Naito and Sonata. That could be awesome. Also coming up on the Patreon, like I mentioned earlier, our Tokyo Dome main event one match series. Definitely at least one episode this coming week with covering the Keiji Muto vs. Takada match from 1995. There you go. So that'll be coming up this week on the Patreon. Again, it's only $5. It is at patreon.com/wrestlingomakase. Our next time on the free feed will be in 2 weeks. I think it'll be the Tokyo Dome Retro Roulette Part 2. I haven't quite confirmed that yet, but I think that's what we'll be doing. So, you know, that'll be another fun one. If you missed Part 1, which I think was Patreon only, we're basically just going to pick 6 random Tokyo Domes and 6 random matches other than the main events, because, again, we're doing the main events in order on the Patreon. So you can get all kinds of wacky stuff here, obviously, when you do a Tokyo Dome Retro Roulette. So that's coming up in 2 weeks on the free feed. In the meantime, thank you as always for listening, and I will see you next time.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
If you've struggled for years to lose weight and have given up hope, did you know you can now access GLP-1 prescription medications through LifeMD? LifeMD is now offering eligible patients online access to GLP-1s, the breakthrough prescription medication that can help you lose body fat and weight. Listen to what people are saying.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
And here's the best part. Your insurance may cover 100% of the cost of your medication. So go to TryLifeMD.com to have your eligibility checked right now. Get started today at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.